Hello and welcome back to Heights Libraries Podcast, Unpacking 1619, where you can explore the interviews we've collected with scholars from around the country, in which we unpack topics relating to race in America. I'm your host, John Pichet, and I'm thrilled to share these interviews with you here. This marks our final episode investigating the legacy of the Eighth Amendment and the U.S. Constitution. This week on the podcast, Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, Alexandra Nadopoff, discusses her book, Punishment Without Crime, How Our Massive Misdemeanor System Traps the Innocent and Makes America More Unequal. Here is our full conversation from back in April 2022.
Thanks so much for having me. My name is Alexandra Nadopoff. I'm a law professor at Harvard Law School, where I teach criminal law and criminal procedure.
Great. And we're going to talk about your book, Punishment Without Crime, How Our Massive Misdemeanor System Traps the Innocent and Makes America More Unequal. And I guess the first question I have for you is, when you wrote the book, well, why did you write the book and what were you trying to achieve with it?
So, you know, for the last decade or so, I think the United States has been in a conversation about mass incarceration. We've started to understand that the way we run our criminal system, the fact that we incarcerate more people than any other country on the planet, is a kind of a failure of our democracy. And it in particular, it's a racial failure, that mass incarceration is not only a legal phenomenon or a criminal phenomenon, but it's also an engine of racial inequality. And it has been for a very, very long time. And I wrote the book because misdemeanors are the missing piece of the mass incarceration conversation. Even when you say the word mass incarceration, you think of people in prison. And the shocking statistics about American incarceration are of course, about our prison population. But prison is, as a technical legal matter, the place where people who have been convicted of felonies serve their sentences. We have 80% of all criminal cases filed in this country are misdemeanors, not felonies. And people are getting locked up, they're going to jail, they're serving sentences, they're accruing fines and fees of hundreds, even thousands of dollars, they're ruining their credit, they're losing their immigration status, they're getting evicted. In other words, enormous, punitive, lasting, debilitating burdens that are visited on millions of Americans in ways that are mass incarceration understanding and conversation does not encompass. So the hope of the book was to explain to people who are interested in this form of governance how our criminal system really works for most people and what its deep flaws are.
Maybe you could speak a little bit more about how the misdemeanor system works. I mean, here in Cleveland, we have a pretty good muni system with public defenders and things like that, but the across the country, I was struck by the fact that there's no formal system for how these like low level and chart. Well, yeah, maybe you could just talk about how it kind of works.
Sure. So sometimes people start by saying, "What's a misdemeanor?" There's a legal answer, but then there's a more important and more interesting answer. So legally speaking, typically when we say misdemeanor, we are referring to criminal offenses for which a person can serve no more than 1 year incarceration. Even that definition is sort of flexible. There are jurisdictions that have 3 or 4 year misdemeanors. In other words, you're sentenced in many ways just like it's a low-level felony. And then there are, on the other end of the spectrum, there are minor offenses, petty offenses that may carry the possibility of a month in jail or 7 days, or as we sometimes call them, they may carry no incarceration. They may be fine only misdemeanors. Much of the traffic code is criminal in this sense. It is 26 states, for example, define speeding as a criminal misdemeanor. Typically, the punishment is limited to a fine, but not always. Many of those speeding cases actually carry the threat of potential incarceration behind, behind our typical traffic understanding. So in other words, the definition of misdemeanor is enormous. It can include what we might think of as conventional serious offenses, domestic violence, drunk driving, all the way to the most minor conduct that many people find hard to believe that we treat as crimes at all, jaywalking, spitting, littering, low level, some we sometimes call them order crimes or order maintenance crimes, like trespassing or loitering, things that people do all the time that are not particularly harmful or dangerous, we treat them as crimes. And so the misdemeanor system, I think, is best understood as this enormous grant of authority that we give to the state to treat us as criminals based on very low-level minor conduct that many millions of people routinely engage in, and that sometimes it's hard to understand why we would think of it as criminal at all.
Yeah, that's important. And I think one of the things that jumped out when I read the book was just how the state uses the misdemeanor process for revenue generation. And maybe you could speak a little bit on how that, sure. Why it works that way.
Yeah, so you asked me sort of the mechanics of the misdemeanor system. The mechanics of any criminal system, you know, or any criminal process in the United States, on paper, look quite a bit alike. Police arrest someone for a crime, a prosecutor charges them with the crime, they have to decide whether to go to trial to contest their guilt or plead guilty. Ours is a system of pleas, not of trials. 95% of all the convictions in this country are the result of a plea, not of a trial. We almost never litigate guilt in this country. That's as true for felonies as it is for misdemeanors. The misdemeanor system, however, has acquired some nasty nicknames, if you will. We sometimes call it assembly line justice or muck justice or even cattle herding. All these derogatory terms refer to the fact that the misdemeanor system is huge, it's fast, it rushes these low-level cases through sometimes in bulk. Literally, judges will stand people up and take their guilty pleas en masse, 5, 10, 15 at a time. Not anything that we would think of as a classic criminal justice process. Because it's fast and sloppy, there's pressure on all the legal officials to move everything along. Judges are telling everyone to hurry it up. Prosecutors are rushing cases through. Public defenders are famously underfunded and overwhelmed and don't have the resources. Not all public defender offices, but the vast majority of them are severely underfunded. So what you get is this kind of hose of cases of people being rushed through the system without legal attention. And so to the extent that the misdemeanor system is working, it's working in ways that I think are at odds with how most people think of a fair, just criminal system in which people have the advice of counsel, in which we are checking the evidence to make sure they're guilty. And checking the law to make sure we got it right. Tail wagging the dog here. You asked me specifically about the role of the money. You can't really understand this enormous rush of cases without understanding one enormous impetus for the scale of the misdemeanor system, which is that misdemeanors generate revenue. They generate fines. They generate fees, not only for the criminal system itself, but many court systems, many cities, states rely on the revenue from this rush of 13 million cases that are being filed. And so one of the reasons that it's so easy to extract wealth from people during the system is because it is fast and sloppy. But one of the reasons that it's fast and sloppy is in order to extract wealth from the people who rush through it. And I'll just mention to end that thought. This has been true since the end of the Civil War. But we really only started to focus on it as a legal and political community after Ferguson, because the Department of Justice issued a report in 2015 investigating the Ferguson Police Department. But what it concluded was that the way the police department was rounding people up for misdemeanors, the way the court was processing them, was part of the fact that the city itself was pressuring these institutions to raise money, essentially running a regressive tax machine through the criminal system. And since then, we've been much more aware of and attuned to this regressive taxation aspect of the criminal system. And there is important and fascinating litigation all over the country challenging that state of affairs.
Yeah, and that kind of answered what was going to be my next question, which was kind of, you know, why would someone plead guilty and, you know, in this process? Because one of the things I learned in your book was that a lot of people are not guilty of the crime that they've been charged with in the misdemeanor court. And there's also this idea that if you can't pay your fine, you end up in jail, which the Supreme Court said is pretrial detention isn't punitive? I don't, maybe you could talk about that.
You packed a whole lot into that question. Let's take the first piece. Why would innocent people plead guilty to something they didn't do? It's hard enough. I think it's hard for people to wrap their minds around it in very serious cases. And yet the innocence movement has shown us that hundreds of people plead guilty to murder in order, for example, to avoid the threat of the death penalty, or to negotiate a sentence lower than life. And so we know that people plead guilty to the most serious crimes that they didn't do. The misdemeanor system, people plead guilty for a wide range of reasons. You mentioned one of the most pressing ones, which is when a person is arrested on a misdemeanor, for example, and we're incarcerated and we're taken to jail, and then we'll be taken before a judge and the judge will set bail. Bail is an amount of money that I have to pay or guarantee in order to be released. It's designed, for example, to ensure that I come back to court in more serious offenses. It's designed, for example, to ensure that defendants don't break any rules while they're on release. It's sort of an incentive not to break those rules. But in the misdemeanor system, often the amount of bail exceeds the amount of the fine or the fee that the person would have to pay, and they can't afford it, which means that they are stuck in jail waiting for their cases to be resolved, not because they're guilty, not because they actually loitered or trespassed or jaywalked, but because they can't afford the bail fee. And so what happens is in the misdemeanor system, the routinely people are offered a plea bargain that would let them go home right away. We sometimes call that time served. So we'll say, you plead guilty, we'll give you 2 weeks, which is the amount you happen to have already served. Or we'll release you and put you on probation with a fine, meaning you'll be under court supervision, but you can go home. And we'll and there's that fine mechanism again, the imposition of a probationary fine, which raises money for the court system. And people take those deals. They have children. They are trying to avoid being evicted. They don't want to lose their jobs. They're languishing in jail because they can't afford to pay. And so thousands, we don't know how many because the process is relatively opaque, but thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people plead guilty to misdemeanors that they didn't commit in order to go home, in order to get out of jail. And it's a huge wrongful conviction docket that disproportionately affects people of color. Disproportionately, of course, by its nature, affects poor people because they are the very ones most likely to be, to be stuck in jail without the ability to pay. And because we over-police these low-level offenses in low-income communities of color, these are the individuals, ironically, most likely to be pleading guilty to offenses that they didn't actually commit.
Yeah, and I think that would be a good transition into the kind of the race aspect of the misdemeanor system, because you mentioned in your book that the misdemeanor system is the greatest threat to racial equality in the country. And maybe you could kind of, and I think you back it up by saying it's a system of surveillance and data collection on poor and people of color. So if you kind of unpack that for us and how it works.
Sure, I'm not sure I would say it is the greatest. It has some very stiff competition for many institutions. I think what I would say is that we should understand the misdemeanor system as one of the panoply of institutions that we think of as perpetuating racial inequality, whether it's poorly resourced public schools in inner cities, or housing segregation, or wage differentials and employment opportunities. And even though we don't think about it this way, the misdemeanor system is right there with all these systems. So the first thing to notice about the misdemeanor system is that it turns very heavily on policing decisions. Police are in many ways one of the most important players in the misdemeanor system because they decide whether you will be arrested for this trespassing or the loitering or the spitting or the disorderly conduct. And because we know that those policing decisions are often racially skewed, and we can see from the data, it's limited data on misdemeanors, not as robust as we have with respect to felonies, but still we can see from the data that that people of color are disproportionately arrested for these low-level offenses. The most famous one, of course, is marijuana possession, which is still the most prevalent low-level drug offense prosecuted in this country. And Black people are four times more likely nationwide to be arrested for marijuana possession than are white people, even though apparently all racial groups, all of us use marijuana at approximately the same rates. Nobody is offending four times the rate of anyone else, and yet we enforce these laws disproportionately against Black people. But we also do it with jaywalking. We also do it with trespassing and loitering, famously disorderly conduct. And so the net that is sweeping people into the misdemeanor system is already racially skewed. And then, as we talked about a moment ago, the system moves fast. Prosecutors are not checking those cases. Those cases are coming in. They're becoming full-fledged criminal cases. People are languishing in jail. And so we are permitted the misdemeanor system to be the way that we first reach out and mark people as criminal for low-level offenses, sometimes things that we wouldn't even think of as criminal at all, disproportionately based on race, disproportionately based on poverty. And then we mark them with arrest records and criminal records, and we strip them of their wealth and their resources and their livelihoods based on the misdemeanor system in these racially disproportionate ways. So that's what I mean when I say it's not just a criminal system, it's a contribution to racial inequality because of the way that we have permitted the misdemeanor system to work.
Yeah, that's one of the things I've learned in my research of all this is how important traffic stops are to just law enforcement in general, but especially to the, the statistic, but if someone's gonna have an interaction with the police, it's gonna be during a traffic stop. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how traffic stops contribute to this system, because I think it's an important, like we think about jaywalking and loitering and those kind of things, those kind of crimes without, but we see traffic stops generating a huge amount of this.
Yes. So again, it's traffic is one of those things that we might not immediately think of as criminal at all. But it turns out that we handle much of the traffic system through the criminal system, and it produces all kinds of dysfunctions and inequalities, as we've been discussing. Most traffic stops are treated as criminal misdemeanors. Some jurisdictions have we might call it decriminalized traffic, or treat the lowest level kinds of traffic as civil, but you always remember those civil offenses still carry fines and fees. And many individuals who cannot pay those ostensibly civil fines and fees still end up incarcerated because they cannot afford to pay, even though they couldn't be incarcerated for the underlying failure to stop at a stop sign or, going 55 in a 30. So there's all kinds of ways that traffic bleeds into the criminal system. So it generates incarceration. We can be, even if we are stopped and charged with the most minor traffic offense failure to wear a seatbelt. The Supreme Court has held that police have the authority to engage in what we call a full-fledged custodial arrest. In other words, they can arrest us, handcuff us, take us to jail. If the jail wants to strip search us, they can do that. We can be incarcerated in jail for days before we see a judge, all on a traffic offense for which we could not be incarcerated by law. So it's really this enormous window into incarceration, into fines and fees, and into the kinds of racial disparities that we've now been seeing for decades in the phrase that we sometimes refer to as driving while black, which captures the data that we have been collecting now for years, which indicates that all too often police disproportionately stop people of color for traffic offenses, even though we all commit traffic offenses at approximately the same rate.
Yeah, and I think the traffic stop, I asked about it because I think it works into this notion of the broken windows, or the Washington Post just had an article, I think this week, about the hotspots where, you know, neighborhoods are designated high crime areas. And maybe you could discuss how that kind of works to criminalize poor and people.
So broken windows is the name of a theory, if you will. Back in the 1980s, a number of cities took up this theory, and it is a theory essentially about misdemeanor enforcement. The argument is that if you over-enforce misdemeanors, if you really crack down on loitering, trespassing, and the kinds of offenses that we've been talking about, that will prevent more serious crime further up the food chain. That the metaphor was that if you see a broken window in a neighborhood, it sends a signal of disorder. You fix the broken window, everyone behaves better. Essentially, that was the theory. And a number of cities, most famously New York, really doubled down on this theory and used it to sweep up people, disproportionately people of color in low-income neighborhoods, into the misdemeanor net on the broken windows theory that this was going to solve crime. And New York is only the most famous city that engaged in it, but also Chicago and Los Angeles, all over the country. And then about a decade or so ago, many cities turned away from that model. New York turned away from it because New York was sued for violating the civil rights of residents of New York through broken windows policing, and they were ordered to stop. But many other cities that did not go through that that litigation process also turned away from it because the empirical data and the evidence suggested that the theory was wrong, that we were arresting all these people for misdemeanors, we were ruining their lives, but we couldn't show that it had any impact on serious crime, which was the whole idea. And so we've been letting go of that model, at least intellectually and in terms of policy. And we have seen, it's a little hard to show causation in this space, but we have seen in the last decade, a drop in misdemeanor arrests in many major cities, which suggests that cities figured out that this was incredibly costly as a social policy and not very good crime policy.
That's great. I think, so what would you suggest? Where are we going and how is this going to, can we do anything about it?
Yes. before I forget, because I know we're drawing to the end of our time, I don't know if it would be interesting to you and your and the members of your library community, but there is a documentary that's based on my book, Punishment Without Crime, and it's called Racially Charged, America's Misdemeanor Problem. And it's a wonderful documentary about the history and also the current racialized practices of the misdemeanor system. It's free on YouTube. it's free for educational groups that want to screen it. Brave New Films is the documentary outfit that made it. And the website is misdemeanorfilm.org. And it's a wonderful resource, and there's lots of educational materials on the website as well. And they and there are lots of experts in addition to me in the documentary explaining different aspects of the history of the misdemeanor system after the Civil War, the way it was turned into a revenue generating system essentially aimed at re-enslaving African Americans to bring them back involuntarily into the workforce through punishment. Anyway, racially charged, America's misdemeanor problem, and it's about all these issues that we've been talking about. You asked me, what can we do? Things are already happening. I don't think we could have even had this conversation a decade ago. We didn't have the bipartisan consensus that mass incarceration is a terrible idea yet. We were still arguing over whether it was a good idea to be the biggest incarcerator on the planet. And now I think, you know, that the fact that we have come to some consensus that mass incarceration itself is expensive, it's unfair, it's ineffectual, has opened up our ability to see that it's even bigger than we thought it was, and that misdemeanors are actually an enormous driver of many of these problems. So what have we seen? We've seen bail reform aimed specifically at the pressures on individuals to plead guilty just to get out of jail. There's litigation all over the country. There's legislation all over the country regarding bail reform, highly contested, but still going in that direction. The Ferguson Report, as we were talking about a few moments ago, really opened our eyes to the problem of revenue, the fines and fees, incentives, and we're seeing states passing legislation to cap the amount, for example, of revenue that a particular locality can generate through fines and fees, understanding that it's a dysfunctional way of running a regressive tax system. The legal and political pushback against broken windows and stop and frisk and the racial disparities and driving while black, I think, have become much more part of our understanding. Of course, it's been an extraordinary few years with the murder of George Floyd and the murder of so many other black men who were all stopped from misdemeanors. Eric Garner in New York was stopped for a misdemeanor. George Floyd himself was stopped on suspicion of a misdemeanor. Michael Brown in Ferguson was stopped for a misdemeanor. Philando Castile in Minnesota was stopped for a traffic misdemeanor. In other words, we're starting to see that misdemeanors are not petty, they're not minor, they're not small. They may actually be the gateway into one of the most disturbing and unfair aspects of our criminal system, which is its disproportionate violence against black men. And all of these conversations are relatively new in the scheme of things. The litigation is new, the legislation is new, the conversation, the progressive prosecutors around the country who are eschewing the use of misdemeanor charges in cases. They're declining cases here in Suffolk County, Rachel Rollins, Los Angeles, the biggest DA office in the country. Prosecutors are saying, we're not going to waste our resources on these low-level offenses. We're going to be fighting violent crime and more serious crime in the communities and using our resources to do that. So all kinds of change is happening. I think the possibilities for change today would have been unimaginable 15 years ago.
Thanks for listening to Unpacking 1619. For more information on Heights Library 1619 Project Discussion Group, or to check out more interviews with scholars, please visit heightslibrary.org. See you next episode, wherever you listen to podcasts.